This is a Building Bridges, your community and labor report special. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
Ken, it's outrageous, but as workers and students demonstrated in support of food service workers' right to unionize at Purchase College SUNY, police were called in to arrest them, and arrest the students they did, including two students who were arrested several days after the peaceful demonstration occurred.
Despite the pleas of workers, students, and faculty, Chartwell's Food Service Corporation, a subsidiary of Compass, a multi-billion dollar multinational corporation, refuses to allow the food service workers on the Purchase campus of SUNY to form a union and engages in unfair labor practices to stifle their efforts to organize. Many of the food service workers earn as little as $14,000 a year and are forced to contribute too much for their health insurance.
Hundreds of students, some clutching signs and beating drums, marched at the Purchase campus recently to protest for better working conditions for the private company's food service workers. They were attempting to deliver Chartwell's CEO, Stephen Sweeney, who was speaking on campus, an award for being the worst employer on campus. 13 students were arrested when the campus called in over 100 outside police, many in riot gear from police departments throughout Westchester County. The workers and students are now protesting the use of excessive police force at the demonstration and are calling for an independent investigation of the administration's handling of the nonviolent protest.
And now union organizers Charles Barley and Cindy Polinsky.
The working conditions of the workers that work for Chartwell's at SUNY Purchase, the average that I've seen is somewhere around $7.58 an hour. On top of that, you know, most of the workers can't afford to pay for health benefits. I know a worker specifically who is a cashier, and she pays $130 in health benefits a week, and she takes home $100, so she pays more out in health benefits than she does take home. A lot of them are immigrant workers, but there are a lot of African-American workers, a lot of Caucasian workers. You get a spread. Westchester, I think, is a fairly diverse county, and it's represented in the workforce. To our estimation, I mean, that's part of the reason why the boss always has the upper hand on top of the union, because they have a list of people. But we believe that there's around 80, 85 workers. They're food service workers. They run the cafeterias that feed the students at SUNY Purchase.
They feed these guys breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and they help give them sustenance when they're studying for exams. They're very close with the students on campus, and that's why we were contacted by the students to organize.
I think that's why the students are taking the side of the workers and doing everything they can to support the workers' right to organize and really trying to pressure Chartwell's into signing a new trialing car check agreement. It is supposed to be a safe space, ideally, for people to be able to express their views. But as we've seen, Chartwell's has come down pretty hard on the workers and not really given them the opportunity to express their views on the union without fear and intimidation. Car check, a very commonly used method to form a union in the United States. Actually, here in New York State, under the Taylor Law, public employees have card check, basically where workers sign a union authorization card or a petition, and if they get 50% plus one, which is considered a simple plurality, you know, it'd be like a majority, right? You know, it's democracy. So, you know, if they get a majority, then the employer will recognize the union.
Under the National Labor Relations Act, one method that people have used is to go through a union election, but actually, over recent years, people have come to the conclusion that National Labor Relations Act no longer really serves the true will of the people, because employers use elections as a way to try to coerce employees away from having a union. So 90% of employers, when there's a union election on the horizon, will hire an anti-union attorney that teaches them how to coerce people into voting no. About 75% have captive audience meetings where they make workers come to meetings and show them anti-union videos. So what these guys very bravely and courageously did was try to work with the employees to actually move a process where people could just sign up for the union in a neutral environment. There had been a decision of a campus board made up of faculty and students and administrators. There was a resolution passed by the PCA board, which oversees vendors like Chartwell's, that Chartwell's should sign a car check neutrality agreement with us. And that was the will of folks on campus that that happened. And Chartwell's actually sent us a letter saying, we don't believe in card check neutrality. We would like the NLRB to police an election. And started to hold captive audience meetings with the workers.
And now we hear from Jesse Lehrer and Rose Goldstein Bookbinder, both Purchase student activists who were arrested in response to the demonstration.
You see a lot of students on our campus fighting to end the war and those kind of things. And when we see these kind of injustices right on our own campus, I think it's the perfect opportunity for us to make a change. I think that's why a lot of students have come out. It's really mobilized our campus. There's a lot of students coming out in support of the workers, and it's been a really incredible process to see so many students coming out. These workers are a part of our community. We have to go see them every day. They're feeding us. And so you see workers that are working, you know, a 12-hour shift or who look exhausted, and so you want to do something to help, and I think that that's why we've come together to do this. And, you know, it's incredible to take part in that kind of change right in your own lives.
Because Chartwell's rejected the neutrality and card check agreement, and because they held those meetings, like, only a few days after they rejected it, where there was instant, like, students need to do something and show their support, and that's how everything got started.
We found out a few weeks ahead of time that the CEO of Chartwell, Steve Sweeney, was going to be on our campus to be holding something that was called Dining for Success.
How to schmooze with your boss.
How to schmooze with your boss. It was something for the seniors to go to before they graduated. So we saw this as the perfect opportunity to present him with petitions that the students and the faculty had signed with over, at this point, 500 signatures, since we have around 800 to 900 signatures. We were going to present him with this and ask him to please sign the card check and neutrality agreement. So this was the plan, and it started off with a rally at an outside theater where we had faculty members speak, students speak, outside community members speak, and in support of what was going on campus, and also just to educate the greater community about this injustice that was occurring. So we proceeded to hold the rally and then go through the different dining facilities, and our final destination was this room to present him with the petitions, and it just...
And the award.
And okay, sorry. All right. We had an award that we had made to present to him that said SUNY Purchase's Worst Employer, and it was a fancy little award with a big banana on the top of it.
The top banana award.
Yeah. So we wound up in this room, and we found ourselves blocked by police, and that was what led us to being arrested. So, I mean, this was a localized peaceful demonstration, and it's actually concerned a lot of students because we don't want this to be a precedent set on our campus. They brought in over 100 police onto our campus in full riot gear with dogs, and we're not quite sure why that occurred. It's kind of the same tactics that they're using on the workers, which is to scare and intimidate us from continuing this movement that we're doing.
Afterwards, I came home to my dorm room one day, and my roommate said, the cops were just here looking for you. And I said, why? And he said, they wouldn't say. So I called the police station. About 5 minutes later, three police officers showed up banging on my door, and I asked what was going on. They wouldn't tell me. They made me come with them. They drove me about 50 feet in their police car for no apparent reason. I felt just to intimidate me. Took me to a room, locked me in the room, still wouldn't tell me what was going on. Came back about 10 minutes later, and then they told me I was arrested. They didn't read me my rights.
And none
of the
13 students who were taken were read their rights either.
Yeah. And I basically asked, well, I really have absolutely no idea why I'm under arrest and why I'm the only one being singled out afterwards. And their response was, you're noticeable and we know who you are, so that's why we arrested you. And I said, okay. I'm the only person afterwards to be arrested.
No, since Andy,
well, actually, yeah, one person who was arrested at the protest was arrested again like 5 days later because they forgot to charge him with something.
Faculty have been incredibly supportive of us, and we've been very thankful for their support. They held a faculty meeting last week where they passed a resolution that said that they were incredibly shocked by all these police on our campus, and they did not want to be seeing this happen again, and that they wanted charges on any students to be halted until there was a private investigation on our campus. Throughout this period, they've been very supportive. The whole Purchase community on a whole has been very supportive.
Call President Thomas Schwartz at 914-251-6010. 914-251-6010. Tell the president that you want all the charges against the students, that's the criminal charges as well as the internal judicial charges that are pending, to be dropped. 914-251-6010. And then tell him to direct Chartwells to honor the card check neutrality agreement and to sign it immediately.
The message is simply let these workers choose to have a union in a safe and harassment-free environment.
We just need to continue to stand with them and push forward. We definitely need as much support from the surrounding community as we can get.
You ought to get involved. Yeah. Get up. Get involved. Yeah. Get involved.
You've been listening to Purchase student activist Jesse Lehrer and Rose Goldstein, bookbinder, and union organizers Charles Barley and Cindy Polinsky.
The students and workers are also in the process of building towards another rally, and some students are talking about going on a hunger strike.
And if you want to join the struggle to organize the food service workers at Purchase College and defend the student activists, call area code 518-257-1401. That's area code 518-257-1401.
And we are going to move swiftly now to look at, this is virtually the 20th anniversary of the catastrophe, the most disastrous industrial accident in the world, of Bhopal, India. And we are very pleased to have with us now a good friend. He is a metallurgic engineer and journalist who turned a Bhopal activist. He arrived in Bhopal the day after the disaster and stayed on and founded a clinic, a nonprofit clinic dedicated to the holistic treatment of gas-affected victims in Bhopal. And the question is, why in the world, 20 years later, Union Carbide has still been not held to task and there has not been justice for the tragedy of Bhopal? And my guest is Sananithi Saranghi.
Satinath Saranghi.
Well, thank you. Please tell us what brings you here now and what is the condition of our sisters and brothers who were affected in Bhopal and what needs to be done.
20 years after the disaster today in Bhopal, the condition is in many ways is worse than it was in the morning of disaster. There are still 150,000 people with chronic illnesses, and people have cancers and tuberculosis and a whole host of problems because of their exposure in 84. And these 150,000 people are still awaiting proper medical treatment because Union Carbide is withholding information on the effect of the gases on the body. In addition, there are tens of thousands of children born to exposed parents who also carry the mark of Union Carbide's poisons. There are about 20,000 people who are forced to consume water contaminated with cancer-causing chemicals, and this also is causing problems to children. And we need to remember that majority of these people were people who earned their livelihood through hard physical labor, and they cannot do it because of their sickness. So we have thousands and thousands of families on the brink of starvation today. And that is why many people who are surviving today and are ill today, they wish that they had died on that night. So the disaster in Bhopal continues, but Union Carbide, which sold itself to Dow Chemical, which is the number one chemical corporation today, refuses to accept the liabilities for the continuing disaster in Bhopal. So we are here to once again to try and force Dow to accept these liabilities. We are here to take part in their annual shareholders meeting at Midland, Michigan on May 13th. And also the other reason that we are here, that two of the leaders of the survivors movement in Bhopal, Rashida B. and Champa Devi, they were honored with the Goldman Environmental Prize this year for the year 2004. So both these sisters are here in Bhopal and linking up with trade unions and student groups and other action groups, community groups that have been impacted by Dow and other industrial disasters. So we are linking up with these groups, community groups, and together raising our demands. We are asking that Dow present Union Carbide in the ongoing criminal case in Bhopal, because Union Carbide is absconding from justice, and so is Warren Anderson, who was the chairman at the time of the disaster. Both are charged with manslaughter in India and other serious offenses, but they're absconding from justice. So we are demanding that Dow is sheltering a fugitive from justice, and that Dow should be made to present Union Carbide in court. And we are also demanding that Dow pay for the medical care costs of the victims and their children. We are asking that Dow clean up the terrible contamination in and around the factory that they've abandoned and just left. And we are saying that because majority of the people who were exposed were workers, more than 70%, who cannot continue with their livelihood today, Dow must provide for their economic rehabilitation.
One of the things that is just incredible to me, there has been a very important decision that came down in the Second Circuit here. Nevertheless, it doesn't seem that it's moved us, or has it, any closer to a real trial. And maybe you can tell our listeners what the decision was relevant to Bhopal, and of course what the response of the U.S. and Indian governments have been.
Yeah, there are two significant cases that are going on. One is in India, in which the criminal case is going on, where Union Carbide Corporation and its former chairman are charged with, as I said, manslaughter and other offenses. But in that, there is a significant judgment expected, which is that we have asked that the court summon Dow and make Dow present Union Carbide in court. And we are expecting a decision on that in June. But at the same time, the Indian government has sent an extradition request for the U.S. government to extradite Warren Anderson. But the U.S., it has been a year since the Indian government sent the request for extradition request to the Justice Department and the State Department, but we have had nothing from the U.S. government. It is yet to respond, and we are still waiting for the U.S. government to send Anderson to India. But the other significant decision that we have had recently, that was on March 17th in the Second Circuit Court of Appeal in the Federal Court in New York, is that this court has upheld the claims of people who have been injured because of water contamination in Bhopal, people who have had their property values reduced because of the contamination. And this judgment is significant in the sense that there's the potential that if the Indian government asks for it, the court may direct Union Carbide to clean up the contamination in and around Bhopal, which will be a historic landmark, because this will be a corporation in one country being asked to do the cleanup, being asked to clean the mess it has made in another country. And because so many of these instances are there all over the world, and the corporations get away with impunity.
The other thing that is of grave interest to me, I just want you to go back and again give a sense of what the environmental reality has been. What are people's lives like? The gas seeped into the water table, but of course you are in such a better position to describe it. What is life in Bhopal like today?
The people, there were 500,000 people who inhaled the gas that night. And these gases, they went across the lung barrier and went into the bloodstream. The poisons circulated in the bloodstream and have damaged every system in the body. So we have people who have been breathless ever since that day without a day's respite. We have people suffering from loss of appetite, from joint pains, pain in the body. Women have menstrual irregularities, chaotic menstrual cycles. And there's a whole host of mental health problems, anxiety, depression, insomnia. One of the commonest problems is people suffer from panic attacks. And also as a result of this exposure, it didn't appear then, but for the last 5 years, we have been seeing an alarming rise in cancers among people. And because the exposure caused damage to the immune system, there's a fourfold rise in tuberculosis. Among the gas-affected people, tuberculosis is 4 times more prevalent than the rest of the country. And what is most worrisome is that children born to exposed parents are also suffering. Our clinic, we did a study last year, which got published in the Journal of American Medical Association, which shows that the children conceived and born after the disaster were shorter and thinner and lighter and had smaller head size. And these were children who were born later, conceived and born later. So quite possibly the even the third generation could be affected. We do not know, because chromosomal aberrations were found among the victims. And what the problem of medical care is there, because one of the big reasons is Union Carbide, that did research at the Carnegie Mellon Institute in Pittsburgh or the Research Triangle Park in North Carolina, it refuses to give us the information that doctors need to treat people. And this information is being withheld by the corporation, saying it's a trade secret and they can't share it with us. We find this the most reprehensible. And the fact that Dow Chemical can say with a straight face that, yes, they have taken over the assets of Union Carbide, but they won't take the liabilities of Union Carbide, which is the liabilities in Bhopal. And here again we find that they are adopting a policy of double standards, because Dow Chemical has accepted Union Carbide's liabilities in the U.S., which are because of the damage caused because of asbestos exposure. They have accepted to pay for these damages in the U.S., but they say, no, we won't accept the damages caused in Bhopal. This again is as Union Carbide, the disaster, one big reason for the disaster was the double standards in safety that Union Carbide followed. And Dow is doing the same thing.
And as we wind up this segment, what do our listeners need to do? I should say that, you know, a report came out from the International Labor Fund, International Labor Rights Organization, rather, just last week, I believe, that talked about 2 million workers who have been killed or injured on the job around the world. And, of course, Bhopal is really the emblematic catastrophe that has still not been resolved for the workers. What do we need to do as we listen to this to support the survivors of Bhopal and insist that Dow Chemical, who now owns Union Carbide, do all the things that are demanded of them to rectify, or at least to bring some modest justice to the people who, as we know, justice delayed is justice denied, but those who have been waiting 20 years, what do we need to tell Dow Chemical to do?
Yeah, before that, I would just like to say that the disaster in Bhopal, it manifested itself as workers' health issues even before the disaster. And the workers had done their best to warn the communities around that such a disaster could take place. And secondly, the other thing is that Union Carbide and now Dow Chemical continues to blame the workers and saying that it was a worker that caused sabotage and that is how the disaster was caused. We think it's a slur against the entire community of workers, and it's the blaming the victim attitude that policy that Union Carbide has undertaken is the same that all industry takes always, and this lie has to be nailed. I would request your listeners to visit our website where these are dealt with, and this is www.bhopalbhopal.net. And we request your listeners to write to Dow Chemical that they provide medical care, provide sums for the contamination cleanup, for economic rehabilitation, and ensure that Union Carbide stops absconding from justice. And if there are any students who are listening on, we have a website for students called www.studentsforbhopal.org.
We've been speaking to Satina Sarangi, a metallurgical engineer turned Bhopal activist, on the disaster in Bhopal, whose effects are still killing today. You've been listening to Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. And to find out more about Building Bridges, you can go to our website at www.buildingbridgesonline.org. That's www.buildingbridgesonline.org.